From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
In the summer of 1854, a cholera epidemic of epic proportions hit London. The method of transmission of the disease was unknown at the time, and there was no proven cure. Stephen Johnson's new book, The Ghost Map, follows the story of two men whose dogged research and willingness to challenge accepted theories transformed our understanding of epidemics, urban planning, and information management. The book is published by the Penguin Group, and it brings Stephen Johnson to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Aren't you the guy who wrote that book that claimed that TV watching and video games actually improved cognitive skill?
No, that was some other guy. No, that was me too. I wrote a book about video games, and then I went to 19th century cholera. It's a logical next step.
Well, perhaps it's because this book is about a contrarian, Dr. Jon Snow, and that might appeal to you.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, I think there actually isn't that much connection between the two books in a funny way. I mean, I wrote a book a few years ago called Emergence that was about, in part, about cities and neighborhoods and how neighborhoods form. And I think that's the book that Ghost Map kind of comes out of more than Everything Bad Is Good for You.
What was Jon Snow's background and how did he become a doctor?
He's such an interesting figure. He was just a kind of classic 19th century character in that he was trained as a doctor. He came out of these kind of working class roots, trained as a doctor, but was just a classic dabbler in a million different fields. So he kind of almost by accident became one of the pioneering kind of experts in anesthesia, which was basically being kind of developed for the first time as a medical procedure.
And he was actually providing the queen with anesthesia during her childbirth.
Exactly right. Yeah, he was the first to do that to Queen Victoria. And he investigated all these kind of subjects on the side in his, you know, just in his spare time while he wasn't treating kind of patients.
But before ether and chloroform, what did surgeons use to dull pain?
There was almost nothing. Alcohol was one of the few things they would use, various forms of opium.
So what was his contribution to the field?
They basically introduced ether and chloroform, but there was a major problem about dosage. And so sometimes they would deliver it and patients would die. Sometimes they would deliver it and they would have no effect. And so he basically figured out a whole procedure to kind of measure the correct dosage, which crucially revolved around the temperature of the room. So he was the first to really kind of make it into something that was truly reliable.
That had to be a leap of faith to come up with the idea that the temperature of the room was a factor. You say that he was a truly consilient thinker.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a term that had been around for a while, consilience, that the Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson kind of repopularized a few years ago in a wonderful book called Consilience. And the idea of consilience is that basically when you're thinking in a consilient way, you're thinking across different scales of experience. So Snow, in his research, particularly his research into cholera, was very much interested in this largely invisible world of microbes, but he couldn't quite see these, you know, kind of microscopic bacteria, but he knew that they were probably there and he was trying to track them down. On the other hand, he was also interested in the human body as a doctor and in the symptoms of cholera, and he was interested in the scale of the city itself and looking at broad patterns in the city and neighborhoods. And being able to move from scale to scale like that, that's the mark of kind of a true consilient thinker.
This is a real departure for you, isn't it? Because this is a historical narrative. You've never done that before.
Yeah, it's the first book that I've done that has a sustained narrative all the way through it. And what I wanted to be able to do is to write a book that was, in a sense, an idea book that was wrapped around a kind of narrative structure.
But I read that you did graduate work in French and British metropolitan novels of the 19th century. So that must have – you mentioned you had – were interested in 19th century metropolises. But was there much about the cholera epidemic in the fiction of that time?
There is a little bit. I mean, one of the themes of this book is waste and the waste that cities produce. Because cholera is all about cities being unable to manage the human waste, basically. And what had happened in London was that, in a sense, the river had gotten infected by all the human waste that was being washed in there. And then people were drinking from the river. And that was an incredibly productive environment to be in if you were a cholera bacterium.
And nobody made that connection? I don't think it takes brilliance to realize that you shouldn't drink water that's been contaminated by human waste.
Well, there was – I mean, I introduced that just to say that Dickens is obsessed with waste. Yeah. And so that was the one connection back to the novels.
And I suspect that Dickens is one of your favorite writers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, those novels of the 1850s, exactly this period, are just incredible books, Bleak House and Our Mutual Friend and Little Dorrit. But yes, there was this amazing – I mean, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this whole story is the authorities basically were convinced that the cholera was in the air and not in the water. And they were so convinced of the airborne theory, basically, that the miasma theory, as it was called, that they were quite comfortable with flushing all this waste into the river to get the smells out of the city, because they were so convinced the smells were killing people. And even though they knew that intuitively that there was something wrong about kind of poisoning the river, the priority was clearing the air. And so it ended up actually the first major kind of public health acts of the late 1840s ended up making the cholera much, much worse because they actually – I mean, if you – a modern-day bioterrorist couldn't have done a more efficient job of poisoning a city's water supply than some of the acts that they enacted in the late 1840s.
So how did Dr. Snow come up with his theory that cholera was transmitted through water? Was this something he'd been thinking about before the epidemic?
Yeah, he developed the theory quite quickly, actually. He started looking into cholera in about 1848. And right around the end of 1848, 1849, he started publishing work suggesting that it was in the water. And he looked at a couple of cases. But he was never able to really convince anybody. And he was pretty much alone in the establishment. And there was one other person who was kind of advocating this. But Snow was pretty much alone in making the case for the waterborne theory. And so when this terrible outbreak came to Soho, where crucially Snow lived, I mean, this is an important part of the story, that he was a member of this community. When this outbreak came to Soho in late August of 1854, it was so intense and so concentrated that Snow thought that this might be an opportunity for him to convince people, because an outbreak that kind of densely concentrated suggested that there was a single point source, that there was some single source where people were getting contaminated water. And if he could find that, then he could maybe make the case for the first time. So it ends up being, in a sense, a kind of detective story where you have this guy kind of going in and trying to track down this villain, in a sense.
He finds a pump that's pumping cleaner water than the other pumps
that had gotten contaminated. And that that's one of the ironies of it, is that this pump was legendary in Soho for having the best water in all of Soho and in fact, some of the neighborhoods around. And so people would come from quite far away to get water from this pump. And it basically had gotten contaminated. And within about a week, 10% of the neighborhood was dead. It was just an incredibly severe outbreak. And part of the interesting kind of project of writing this book is to try and recreate what that was like, that feeling of kind of urban terror when you wake up and suddenly your whole family is dead or 10% of your neighborhood is dead.
So this brings you back to the time that you were studying fiction of the 19th century. Here's your chance to write a novel without having to make up the character.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it was incredibly fun, I have to say. I mean, as morbid and dark as part of the story is, to get back into that kind of mindset. And I think one of the great things about this period, too, that's so interesting is London as a city. I mean, I really wanted London to be, in a sense, a character in this book as well. And London was a city of 2.5 million people. It was the largest city in the world, but it was also the largest city that had ever been in the history of the world. And so they were literally living through this whole project of trying to live on that scale for the first time.
And growing very fast.
Growing very fast and out of control. And, you know, people would look at it and say, this can't go on. This is not a sustainable thing.
And were there people who were involved in urban planning at the time? Were there such things as urban planners?
There was the beginning. I mean, they had to kind of invent a lot of these systems in response on the fly, in response to these things. They ended up building the sewers. Precisely in response to the threat of cholera, as Snow's theory became more and more widespread and more accepted, they finally sat down and decided, okay, we're going to have to deal with this problem. And they built an amazing, probably the most important engineering achievement in the 19th century, the London sewer system. And crucially, they solved the problem. I mean, this is the thing that makes it not just a story of kind of death and devastation in Victorian London. The last cholera outbreak in London was 1866, 12 years after this outbreak in 1854. And since then, cholera has not come back to London.
You said that the increase in population for the earlier outbreak brought with it an increase in corpses, and then there was the problem of what to do with them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's all in that theme of managing waste and managing
throw them in the river.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were actually, you know, our mutual friend, the Dickens novel, starts with this scavenger daughter and father pulling a corpse out of the river to look through its pockets for change. So they did.
So was
sometimes.
That a typical thing?
There were folks who just lived along the river. They're sometimes called the muckrakers, looking for food.
My guest is Stephen Johnson, whose book, The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. It's published by Riverhead Books, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Stephen Johnson, whose latest book is The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. It's published by Riverhead Books. What is The Ghost Map?
The Ghost Map is a map that Snow ended up making of the epidemic. What he had done is basically assembled this list of kind of all the people who had died with the help of this very interesting other character, Reverend Whitehead. And he had basically a list of kind of people who had died and where they lived. But if you put that up as a kind of statistical table and looked at it, it didn't intuitively kind of point to this contaminated pump in any kind of real way. And so he hit upon the idea of representing the outbreak in map form. And so what he did was basically he took an overview of the neighborhood and he put these little black bars at each address representing a death. And so right near the pump, there were a couple of houses that had 10 or 12 people who died. And so you would see 10 or 12 black bars there. And so when you looked at the map, immediately you could see this kind of black bars kind of radiating out from this pump and growing, you know, kind of less pronounced the further you got from the pump. And so it was a way of kind of resurrecting the dead of the neighborhood in order to crucially reveal this pattern, to show that this unequal kind of distribution of deaths was pointing to this contaminated source.
And that convinced the people who could change things?
It did in part. I mean, this is another thing that's so interesting about this story is sometimes when it's been told and taught, it gets kind of condensed down to he pointed, you know, revealed the pump and the mystery was solved and the cholera was eliminated. But in fact, it was much noisier and slower than that. He convinced some of the authorities at the time, but a number of kind of the official citywide authorities thought his theory was ludicrous. But over time, this particular outbreak and the map that Snow made of it became the kind of great example that people would point to when they talked about their waterborne theory. And in some sense, the map became a kind of marketing device for Snow's idea. It kind of helped popularize his theory.
And he was also he depended on a compilation by a man named William Farr.
Yeah.
The Weekly Returns of Births and Deaths.
Yeah. He would read these statistical tables that Farr would put out.
Farr was using them to support the miasma theory that it was airborne.
Yeah, Farr was he had a kind of slightly nuanced theory. He wasn't as hardened a miasmatist as some of the other folks were, but Farr had one very crucial insight, which is that he forced doctors to start reporting cause of death along with just the fact of a death. And so he started assembling these tables in the 1840s that would show exactly how many people had died of cholera and where they died of cholera. And so that gave Snow this amazing kind of database of information that he could then kind of work on.
The Edwin Chatwood is the at least one of the villains of this story. But he also had a tremendous effect on the science of urban planning.
In some ways, Chadwick is, I paint him probably less sympathetically than I should. He helped invent a lot of things that we now take for granted about, kind of public health infrastructure. And the idea that this part of the role of the state to intervene and help, these issues that cities need help with. But he was so convinced that the air was poisoning the city and so opposed to any other kind of theory that he ended up in the short run doing, I think, more harm than good. He was famous for saying testifying before Parliament that all smell is disease. That was his big slogan.
Wow, that was his theory?
Yeah. Just basically, if it's smell, you're getting sick from it. And if there's any other explanation, there's no validity to that at all.
I wonder how he explained food.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. Cooking. What is cholera, and how does it kill people?
It is a bacteria that basically causes all the fluids from your body to kind of drain out in the space of about 48, 36 hours. So it's a terrifying death. Your body is obviously hugely dependent on the presence of water in many different ways. And one of the things that happens is, in a sense, there's this kind of internal triage that happens where all your secondary organs shut down and the body just tries to keep the heart and the brain alive, which means that you have this very disturbing awareness of your fate as you're fading out towards death. People are kind of shockingly kind of alert even as they're right on death's door.
Well, this wasn't the first cholera outbreak in London. So do we have any idea why they come and go?
Well, they arrived in 1832. For the first time in London. It had kind of swept through Europe over the 20 years before that, but it never actually crossed the channel. But it thrives basically in situations where people are accidentally ingesting other people's waste. That's how it works. And so it thrives in large, dense metropolitan areas where they don't have proper sanitation.
Did anyone think about rehydration as a cure?
There were a couple of early physicians who suggested that, and then it kind of dropped off. And there's one of the things I talk about in the book is just a ridiculous number of quack cures for cholera that people went through. But that's one of the tragic things about it is it's actually a very easy thing to treat if you just rehydrate people, and it's now entirely treatable. I mean, one of the doctors I talked to in researching this book, this scientist at Harvard, was telling me in passing about some experiment that he'd done. He said, well, we took these test subjects and we gave them cholera and then we did these experiments on them. And I said, wait, you gave the test subjects cholera? And he said, oh, yeah. I mean, as long as you've got an IV there, it's 100% safe. And I thought, those are pretty game experimental subjects, for $11 an hour to get cholera. I'm not sure if I'd do it.
Well, now we don't have much cholera in the world, so I guess they know what they're doing. My guest is Stephen Johnson. His latest book, The Ghost Map, The Story of London's Most Terrifying Epidemic and How It Changed Science, Cities, and Modern World, and the Modern World. It's from Riverhead. The Reverend Henry Whitehead is a key player in proving Snow's theory. And this man wasn't even a scientist or a doctor.
Yeah, that's part of the story that I found so interesting when I was writing it. And I hadn't realized, and I think in general, Whitehead has been ignored in this story, but it turns out he really is crucial to solving the mystery because he ends up tracking down the kind of patient zero of the case that started it all.
Which is odd because clergy often are put in the position of just simply reassuring people and talking about God's will.
Yeah, well, what happened is that he was one of these wonderful kind of neighborhood figures who just knew everyone. And he had this great kind of social intelligence, social networking, which Snow did not have. Snow was not a particularly kind of socially attuned guy. He was a genius, but he was not the person you'd sit around chatting with for long periods of time. And Whitehead was the exact opposite. And so when it came time to track down all these people, many of whom had fled, Snow needed this guy, Whitehead, who had kind of gotten roped into this accidentally almost. And they ended up really kind of developing the case together and became really quite great friends.
Although he had started off trying to disprove Snow's theory.
He initially heard the theory that the pump was the culprit and said, oh, that's the best water in Soho. I could easily disprove that. And he went around and started to talk to people and slowly came around.
You said that he often found that children were the mission link to the pump.
Yeah, people would send their kids out to get the water and then bring it back. And sometimes people would report to Snow or the other investigators and say, oh, we haven't had any water in the house. And then it would turn out, oh, in fact, our 8-year-old went out and got it, and that's how it got in the house.
And Snow and Whitehead started sharing information?
Yeah, they started kind of working as a team. And Snow showed Whitehead an early draft of his kind of pamphlet he was working on. And I think that Whitehead said later that that was the thing that finally kind of turned him around to believe that the pump was the culprit.
What's an index case?
An index case is the kind of original patient zero case, the start of an epidemic. If there is some epidemic, you know, you never really track that down. But in this case, we know it was a 5-month-old girl who lived across the street from the pump who was the first case in the neighborhood.
But this is not contagious. They must have assumed that there was a contagious factor initially.
Well, that's the tricky thing about it is that it's you can get it from kind of soiled linens and things like that, but it's not contagious in the way that, you know, the flu is contagious. So in this case, basically they emptied out the diapers of this baby in a cesspool in the bottom of this house, and the cesspool leaked into the well, and that's how the disease traveled.
Had Snow's background helped him in doing all of this? I mean, he was an anesthesiologist.
Yeah. Well, it helped him in a number of different ways, and that's, I think, that's such an interesting question. Why was he able to see something that other folks weren't able to see? Part of it was a class thing. He'd come from this working class background, and there was a lot of the talk about the disease because it tended to hit working class poor neighborhoods much more severely than upper class neighborhoods. So there was a lot of just kind of assumptions like, oh, that's the immoral working classes. That's why they're getting sick. And Snow had none of that because he had none of that kind of bias working in his perspective. And then in terms of anesthesia, he was very much aware of the diffusion of gases. And so he understood that if the miasma theory were right, then people who worked right in the smelliest areas should be dying at a disproportionate rate. But in fact, they weren't doing that. So he had a number of different kind of forces come together.
How long before this became the accepted answer? Because there had been cholera epidemics, as you said, all throughout Europe. New York had a situation. It was a fast-growing city. It had probably faced similar problems.
Yeah. In London, by the epidemic of 1866, enough of the authorities had been convinced of it, including Farr, that when the outbreak happened, they immediately assumed it was probably a water problem, and they started posting all these notices saying, boil all your water. And so that was one of the first times you saw an institution kind of come into an actual outbreak and say, okay, we're going to assume that this is a water problem. And by the 1870s, 1880s, I mean, they reversed the Chicago River in response to a cholera outbreak. So by that point, people had pretty much accepted it. But by the way, it's worth pointing out that we have really successfully eliminated cholera from the developed world, but it continues to be a huge killer in the developing world and the megacities of the developing world. So it's sadly, although we know how to treat it and we know how to solve the problem, we haven't eliminated it.
Because waste disposal remains the same as it was in the 19th century in
Absolutely.
Places like India and elsewhere.
Absolutely.
How is the model that Snow and Whitehead developed used in contemporary life? Does the internet make these kinds of collaborations easier?
Yeah, that's one of the points I get to at the end of the book, which is that their kind of local neighborhood expertise that they had, their ability to track down all these things, to see these patterns, to know their neighbors and know exactly what was happening kind of on the ground. The internet is increasingly becoming a place where that knowledge and expertise gets shared. So you see that sometimes in local bloggers who are writing about their neighborhoods. I think you have Brownstoner on your show occasionally. He writes about Brooklyn blogs. And one of the things I've done kind of in concert with this book is I've helped develop this site called outside.in, which is basically enabling people who live in neighborhoods all around the country, mostly in city neighborhoods, to share the kind of local knowledge that they have, to get the kind of Henry Whiteheads of city neighborhoods, to put that information they have about, not necessarily about a terrible disease, but about a troubled public school or an interesting new playground that's been proposed or the restaurant that's opening around the street, to get that stuff online so that you can go, in our case, you can go to Outside In, type in your neighborhood, type in your zip code, and instantly see all those conversations.
If we hadn't discovered a way to deal with epidemic, would the history of cities be different? Because in the 19th century, they were seen as places of disease and pestilence.
There's no question they would be different. I mean, the big change in all of this is that cities, on average across the world, are now places where if you move to the city, your life expectancy gets longer rather than shorter, which was exactly the opposite in the 19th century.
But there are people who believe that some threats from terrorism might change that, and we might see the same sorts of things that we saw in the 19th century because so many people are concentrated into such a small area.
You know, it's a huge part of, you know, what they call asymmetric warfare, the ability of small groups, terrorist individuals, to inflict huge damage. Part of that is technological. You can now have a suitcase nuke or something like that. But part of it is people are congregated in these dense humans. 50% of the planet now lives in a metropolitan area. And so in 9/11, you know, the technology that caused the most loss of life on that day was the technologies that enabled 50,000 people to work in an office building. Without that concentration, it wouldn't have been as deadly an attack.
Why do you think Jon Snow is not remembered as well as some of the other people who have changed the course of medical history?
Yeah, I hope that maybe that this, if this book does anything, it will help Snow's reputation. You know, he was not a very charismatic guy.
Was Louis Pasteur?
Maybe not.
A great charismatic guy.
Yeah, I don't quite understand that. I hope that I think he's better now. And I'm going over to London on Saturday night to promote the book there. It's coming out on Tuesday, and I think he's better known in the UK, of course. I think he should be better known here.
And after this, how long before London started developing new ways to get water?
Well, they had this kind of system of private water companies patchwork kind of throughout the whole city. And once they cleaned up the sewer system, once they got the sewer system working by the 1870s, the Thames got quite clean quite quickly. And so they didn't actually for a while need many other solutions.
And they were taking their water out of the Thames?
Yeah.
Now they don't, I assume.
I assume not, but I actually don't know the answer to that.
And
question.
In New York, of course,
we dealt
with it by building reservoirs.
Yeah.
And first reservoirs in Central Park and then reservoirs upstate.
Yeah.
Stephen Johnson's book, The Ghost Map, The Story of London's Most Terrifying Epidemic and How It Changed Science, Cities, and the Modern World, is published by Riverhead Books. And I want to thank you so much. Where do you go from here?
I don't know. I have video games to cholera. I'm not sure what's after that.
Well, perhaps figure out how to end cholera is good for you might be
that's
kind
right.
of a title for a future book.
There we go.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.